I wonder what your treasure is. I mean, it may be something that you particularly treasure, or it might be someone. It might be a special person. You might even formally call them treasure, precious, and my little treasure, my special treasure. Or you might have a secret treasure in that your someone might not know that they are your special treasure. But you know when they walk in the room. I mean, is your treasure finding a marriage partner? Is that what you treasure? I mean, that is a treasure for some of my friends, or some friends, what they treasure is getting pregnant. There's a couple, they've been longing to get pregnant for years, and that's all consuming for them. Or your treasure might be to make a lot of money. Or it might be the goal of having a big house, or it might be that I want a sailing boat, or it might be that I want a ski lodge, or it might be I want to head up a big company, or to buy out a competitor, or to build a reputation, or to achieve a promotion, or I'm seeking to advance. Some of my friends, their treasure is to be pre-selected for Parliament and then elected for Parliament. Or treasure might be to be famous on the stage or the screen, or to be a respected author, or my byline is prominent, or body image. Treasure, positive body image. I think what we really treasure governs our lives. What we value consumes our time. That my plans, my daydreams, my direction, it ultimately revolves around my treasure. My efforts to achieve revolve around my treasure. Look with me, Matthew chapter 6, this passage that we're looking at today, and this quote from Jesus that's there on the outline from sentence 21 there, and Jesus says, "Where your treasure is, there your heart will be." And I think Jesus is saying that I am going to be relentlessly moving towards the place that my treasure is. Whatever my treasure happens to be, I'm on a journey there. I'm moving towards that object to which I've got my gaze fixed. And what we're doing in this series is studying this great address, this great Sermon on the Mount address that Jesus gave. And last week, we looked at the difficulties of being sincere. And Jesus challenged us on a number of activities. If you were with us last week, you might be engaged in prayer, or you might be somebody who gives money. And he's saying, when you do what you're doing, are you doing it in order to be praised by other people? Or are you doing it because your Heavenly Father, God in heaven, would be pleased with you? And the root issue last time was, what's your perspective on life? You're living for others, or are you living for God? Am I doing what I'm doing in order to be seen, or am I doing it because I'm sincere? And that question today actually gets sharper. And the challenge comes to us today from Jesus, and we're going to be seeing it from several different perspectives, but the challenge from Jesus is to seek first his kingdom. And that's going to flow out in all sorts of ways. And so Jesus begins today by talking to us about priorities. And there's three questions that he puts to each of us, three metaphors on what is top priority. And the first one is treasure. And so from sentence 19, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, where the thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasure in heaven, when moth and rust do not destroy, where thieves do not break in and steal, for where your treasure is, there your heart is. Now, we've got to be clear here on what Jesus is saying and what he's not saying. I don't think Jesus is banning possessions. I don't think Jesus is banning saving for a rainy day. I don't think he's banning superannuation. I don't think Jesus is teaching us that we should despise the things of earth, the things of God's creation. They're good things given us by God the Creator to enjoy. You say, all right, if you don't think that, Dominic, what do you think he's saying? Well, I think he is speaking about material possessions, material treasures. And I think Jesus is saying, don't make material possessions what you treasure. Don't make them your focus. Don't make them what you live for. He's really arguing strongly, powerfully. Don't have the direction of life of the 1980s philosophy of greed is good. The 1980s philosophy of Wall Street, the movie. That's not the way to go. I was talking to a friend in their 20s about this, and he says, yeah, Dominic, I'm with you. I'm with you on this. I'm not a materialist like mum and dad. I mean, I'm not obsessed about having a mortgage. I'm not obsessed about home loan. I'm not like that. And then the conversation turned to his CD collection. And he was a materialist. And he was a materialist about CDs, and then we moved on to clothes, and he was a materialist about clothes. And whether your treasure is the old style, I'm an old style materialist, or a new style materialist, building the house or building the wardrobe, I don't know anyone who doesn't struggle with this question of where is my treasure? Is it here on earth, or is it in heaven, as Jesus would have our treasure? And that's a very sharp question for everyone, for me, for you. Because Jesus says, where your treasure is, whether it's here on earth or in heaven, that's where you're going to be focused. That's what the direction of life is going to be. And so if you are someone who's beginning to step forward in a relationship with Jesus, just trying to work out what it means to look like, to be his disciple, to be his follower, he puts it to us sharply as a question today, where's your treasure? Where's your direction? Last week he taught us about the Lord's Prayer. And he taught us to pray, Our Father in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come. And the idea there in the Lord's Prayer was that I'm praying God's kingdom would come, God's rule would come, that people would recognize God's rule, that I would recognize God's rule, that God would rule in my life. And Jesus is challenging us, do I want him to be the ruler in charge of my life? Next question, next challenge from Jesus. It comes in sentence 22, and it's the subject of ambition. And Jesus says, 22, the eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? And I've got to say, what's my eye on? We saw a couple of chapters ago Jesus speak about himself being the light shining in the darkness. And the question for me is today, is my eye on Jesus, that light? And am I as a person radiating that light? Or is my eye on darkness and am I radiating darkness? Third question from Jesus, who's my master? Comes in 24. No one can serve two masters. Either he'll hate the one and love the other, or be divided to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. I can only have one top priority. Now, Jesus here, we've got to be clear, is not saying, look, I know you're very talented and you'll find this difficult to serve two masters, but if you just kind of maintain the life balance and get the juggling right, it'll eventually be possible. I mean, you might end up being on one side of the equation or the other side of the equation, but eventually you'll be able to get the perfectly balanced life of serving God over here and money over here, and you'll be able to do it. That's not his paradigm. Jesus says, it's impossible. You cannot do it. I can't do it. We can't do it. It's impossible. And so therefore the sharp question comes to me, well, what is God? Who is God? Who is my master? Is it money or God? Who am I serving? There's an old saying, the last part of a person to become a follower of Jesus, the last part of a person to become a Christian is the hip pocket, is the purse, is the wallet. But it's wider than money. Who am I serving? I see people walk away from Jesus for all sorts of reasons. And ultimately, it's they decide something else, someone else is my master. I think there's actually a gender divide on this. I might get in trouble for saying this, but I think my observation is there's a gender divide in that I see women struggle on this issue. And they look to me like their number one priority in life is Jesus. And they look to me like they're serving Jesus, and then a new man comes on the scene. And he doesn't love Jesus. And I see their attention as distract, as they push Jesus aside and follow this new guy. And life revolves around this new boy. Now, I understand a man who isn't Christian wanting to go out with a Christian woman because Christian women are wonderful. I understand that, but I think it's awful watching a Christian woman choose second best, thinking she can have this bloke and have Jesus and juggle them and maintain it. She can't. You cannot do it both. She can't do it successfully. or I see men struggle on this issue of who am I going to serve. Women struggle here too, but I see lots of guys struggle. I've got to make a job decision or the decision to do with work. And which one will I take? And one's offering the biggest salary, but it's putting Jesus second. I'm going to have to push Jesus aside. I mean, we've seen guys here in the City Bible Forum who've been really keenly serving Jesus. And then as the promotion comes, as the job gets more demanding, Jesus has been squeezed further and further out of their priorities, and they haven't been able to maintain it. And the question for us is, which will come first? He's calling on us to a life of uncompromised trust in him. And he says, do not worry about the physical things, the material things. 25, do not worry about your life, what you'll eat, what you'll drink, what your body, what you'll wear. Now, I don't know if you, but you read that sentence, probably you read that sentence and you think, well, hang on, Jesus, well, what about my mum who's just been diagnosed with breast cancer? Or what about my wife just leaving? Or an SMS. I got one from my friends. Peter is in hospital again. This came to me at 11 o'clock on Tuesday night. His heart is not working properly. Aortic fibrillation. Now, he's a mate who almost died of a heart attack last year. And you say, well, hang on, I'm worried. And Jesus gives this piercing statement. I tell you, do not worry about your life or what you eat or drink, about your body, what you wear. And you say, well, hang on, Jesus, what about you try living? What about if your wife gets breast cancer, if you're divorcing, if your mate is sick? You could go off on a tangent at this point and start to think, well, hang on, and there's a whole lot of things that would be really good if somebody did do a bit of worrying about. It'd be really good if somebody actually did worry about global warming. And somebody did, that'd be good if somebody worried about that. If somebody did worry about the environment or economic oppression or racial prejudice or cruel regimes or weapons of mass destruction or AIDS in Africa. I mean, and I've not even started there on the issues at work. Let me try and speak with clarity on exactly what I think Jesus is saying here. I want to give you two propositions. First one, to worry is good, and not to worry is irresponsible. And the second proposition, to worry is wrong, and to worry shows unbelief and disobedience. I think there's two different kinds of worry, which I think there's three. I think there's a medical one. There's the condition of anxiety, which I'm not really going to explore at all today. But there's a right kind of worry. It's right and proper at points for the follower of Jesus to worry. And the Apostle Paul, Jesus' Apostle Paul, puts it like this in one of his letters, in the second letter to the Corinthians. He writes in chapter 11, 28, besides everything else, I face daily the pressure of my concern for the churches. Who's weak and I do not feel weak? Who's led into sin and I don't inwardly burn? He's saying there's times when it's right to worry. There's times when it's right to feel the pressure, when it's right to be concerned. But Paul in Philippians 4, one of his other letters, he talks about taking your worries, your concerns to God in prayer. So he recognises there are things that I can't deal with, that are too big, that I'm concerned about, that I speak to God in prayer. I hand them over to God in prayer. The second kind of worry is the worry that indicates a disbelief, unbelief, disobedience. And this is the kind of worry that I take it is wrong. Jesus in Matthew chapter 13, you might want to jot that down and look it up a little later, but a few chapters later in this account, he speaks of the person coming into relationship with God, beginning in relationship with God, and then as they go on, the worries of life, the deceitfulness of wealth, choke, and come in and choke that seed that's growing in their life and cuts them off. And then the beginning of relationship of God with God that started is ended. It's a kind of worry that doesn't trust God, that indicates an acute shortage of confidence in God. What kind of worry do I think Jesus is speaking of here in Matthew 6? I don't think Jesus is advocating a carefree irresponsibility. But I do think Jesus is saying it's not valid for a disciple to be worrying about the material necessities. Now look how he argues the point. He says God's going to look after our needs. And to make that point, he uses a greater than, lesser than argument. I'll just read it and then I'll unpack it. First in 25, Jesus says, is not life more important than food? The body more important than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They don't sow or reap or store away in barns, yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? And down to 28, and why do you worry about clothes? See how the lilies of the field grow? They don't labour or spin. Yet I tell you that not even Solomon, in all his splendour, was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown in the fire, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? So don't worry saying, what will we eat, what will we drink, what will we wear? It's a greater than, lesser than argument. God's done the lesser thing, therefore he'll do the greater thing. He's fed the birds, he'll feed you. But implied, God's done the greater thing, he'll do the lesser. God has saved you. God has sent his son Jesus to die in your place that you might be right with him. So will he look after your needs today? Yes. Don't worry about that. Now, I don't think Jesus is saying, well, okay, if I'm not to worry about that, therefore I'll quit this job and I'll just stay home and money will come in the post. I don't think that's what Jesus... the birds still had to go and gather seed, but God looked after them. Second one Jesus gives is that don't worry. He says, don't worry because worry doesn't work. 27, who of you by worrying can add a single hour to his life? Doesn't work to worry, so don't. Third reason not to worry, it relates to the future. 34, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. He's saying, don't worry about whether tomorrow's crop will fail, because tomorrow's crop might not fail. His point really is, today is the tomorrow that you worried about yesterday, and today's okay, and so tomorrow will be manageable too. Don't worry about tomorrow. It's almost like he's saying, there's going to be some unavoidable worry, but at least limit your unavoidable worry to the worry of today. Because don't chase out the, if this happens, and then if this happens, and if that happens, and then if that happens, and that happens, and if that happens, then that'd be disaster. Because you might not get it up those ifs on the, but do you find yourself doing that? I do. And he says, don't go down that train. You think, hang on, but what if I don't have enough money? What if I can't work it out? He says, 32, for the pagans, the people who aren't Christian, they run after these things, and your heavenly Father knows you need them. See, the pagan, the non-Christian, the person who isn't Christian, the atheist, lives in a closed universe. They live in a universe that does not recognise that God exists, that there is a God who oversees and superintends affairs. And if there is no sovereign God, then worry. But if there is a sovereign God, if there is a God who controls everything, then I can bring my concerns to him. So if I want to be a follower of Jesus, if I want to be one of his disciples, if I want to take him seriously, if I want to see that he is Lord of the universe, then don't worry about the material stuff the way the person who isn't one of his disciples does. So you and I, we've all got traumas this week. There's things going on in our life, things going on at the office, things that we don't like, there's people being difficult. And the question for us is, how do I respond to that? Do I respond with the same words, same issues, same sentiments that the other people in the office do? I think Jesus is saying the true follower of his is going to be distinctively different at that point. And when I'm under pressure, when things are really hard at work, that's when my attitudes will be seen and exposed for what they really are. In the Roman Empire, the 4th century, the emperor was attempting to suppress Christianity. And he was using all sorts of methods to suppress Christianity, like murder and torture. And he gave it a really good go and failed. And he failed largely because the Christians of the 4th century were living such different lives to the people around. I mean, and when they were under pressure, their lives were shown for what they actually were. And the emperor in the end was first to call off the persecution, forced to say to his officials, "We ought to be ashamed. Not a beggar is to be found among those Christians. These people feed not only their own people, but ours as well, and our people get no help from us." Under pressure, the 4th century Christians didn't live the same as the rest of the Roman Empire. Faced with much greater adversities than us, they were different. I just think it'd be phenomenal if Alan Jones or Virginia Trioli or John Laws or Kerry O'Brien was to say, "We ought to be ashamed. Look at those Christians as they deal with the stresses." I mean, they're coping with the pressures of life, the mortgage, the work, the family, and they're coping with the added pressure of us bagging them. And they're coping so well. What is the challenge? What is the alternative to worrying about the material things? Well, Jesus says in 33, and he really gets to the heart of the matter here, "Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given you." And so the question on the table for each of us today at the City Bible Forum is, seek first the kingdom. Actually, it's more than a question, isn't it? It's a challenge. Is that your life? Are you about seeking first the kingdom? You say, "Oh, hang on, Dominic, I mean, I'm only here for the first time. I mean, that's a bit heavy." I'm really glad you're here. I hope you'll keep coming. And it is a confronting challenge from Jesus today. Because it's confronting, because essentially Jesus is saying the things that everyone else in the CBD says are important, he says they're not important ultimately. And to change, to think like Jesus, is going to require a Copernican revolution in the way my attitudes. So it's a very strong speech, this address from Jesus. Because he's challenging us to get right to the bottom of this, of questioning our priorities, of what is my treasure as I walk out of this place and back to the factory to go back onto the production line this afternoon. I know it's not true, but I'm just imagining. What is my worry going to be? What is my concern going to be? What is my focus going to be? Am I about seeking Jesus' kingdom or worrying about the stuff of the world? The one Jesus who's speaking, who's putting this challenge, who's making this demand, he is the one who died. Died that I might be right with God, and then rose again to the right hand of the Father in heaven, and speaks to us and issues this challenge as the Lord of heaven and earth, and the one to whom on the last day I'm going to have to give an account. I'm going to have to say, "Oh God, I worried and I shouldn't have. Or I listened and I trusted." 2 points of application. I've got to make a decision. Where will I work? What will I spend money on? Where will I live? Where will I work? Well, the CBD's got a procedure for making a decision on a subject like that. Does it offer more money? Does it offer more responsibility? Will I have more fun? Whereas Jesus gives us a paradigm, am I seeking first the kingdom? What would the king have me do? How can I best advance the kingdom? And how will that influence the job choice that I make? Where will I live? Well, the CBD's got a formula, the best house I can afford in the suburb I can afford that's reasonably close to where I'm working. It's all about me. And Jesus' paradigm is, where would be best to live so that I can advance his kingdom? Is this a place that I can see myself serving Jesus in? Or spending money? In terms of the way my check account looks, the checks that get written, does my check account reflect that Jesus is a priority in my life? Or do I spend money in terms of the kingdom just as a loose change thing on the side? There's a real challenge to us there. We'll take questions and comments on those two. Now, here's the questions. Three of them relate to verses 22 and verses 23. One of the questions is, seems incongruous or out of place, seems to relate more to spiritual blindness and darkness than riches in heaven and earth. What's your take on it? Go back to verses 22 and 23. The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? Now, I can see where you're coming from in asking that that question. As I had that verse in mind, I had also in mind, relating to this subject, what he said earlier, that in chapter 4 of Matthew's Gospel, and you'll remember here that we're in the end of chapter 6, but in chapter 4, verse 12, when Jesus heard John had been put in prison, he returned to Galilee, lived in Nazareth. He went, lived in Capernaum, which was by the lake in the area of Zebulun and Naphtali, to fulfill what was said through the prophet of Isaiah. Land of Zebulun, land of Naphtali, the way to the sea, along the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people living in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. And really it was that it had been dark for 400 years, and suddenly God is speaking again. There's light, and it's a piercing light in darkness. And then I talked, as we began this series, about that light of Jesus shining in the darkness and me being drawn to it like a moth to the spotlight, and both that light piercing but also cutting and burning. And so Jesus picks up on that very image at the very beginning of Matthew's account, the Sermon on the Mount, and he says, to you and me, followers, disciples of Jesus, is you are the light of the world. He was the light of the world. Now he says, you are. A city on a hill cannot be hidden, neither do people light a lamp, put it under a bowl. Now, so he's running with that paradigm of you should be light, you should be shining, and then he says, here, the eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. So I've seen it, is my eye on Jesus? Is my eye fixed on the searchlight, the spotlight of Jesus, or am I focused on the darkness? That's how I took that verse. I hope that's helpful there. A couple of other ones. Does God really look after our physical needs, e.g. food, clothing, etc.? What about Christians living in poverty in Africa? Yes, it's very important that when we teach the Bible, we not just see that the Bible is true for middle-class Australians, but is also, I mean, I've got to be able to say, does this passage hang true speaking in the AIDS orphanage in Africa? And we've got to take this passage, I think, as meaning, therefore, that I've got to seek his kingdom and he will look after what I need physically. Look after. Now, you say, well, has he always looked after people physically? Well, I've got to remember that there's verses in the Bible where he speaks about, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, though he lead me through the shadow of the valley of death. I mean, he's talking there about difficulty, he's talking there about pain, he's talking there about suffering. Now, I haven't suffered in the area of not being able to have enough food to put on the table for my children. But I've had some extraordinarily difficult times, extraordinarily difficult emotional, extraordinarily difficult relational times. And I have felt that God has been with me. Now, this is why I am so profoundly disturbed by what is called in the jargon the prosperity gospel. And this is a distortion of biblical Christianity. It's a distortion of biblical Christianity which says, come to Jesus and you'll be rich. And it's wicked and it's awful. I mean, it looks like Jesus, it smells like Jesus, but it is not biblical Christianity. And it's coming out of America and it's coming out of Australia and it's being sold to Africa and it's kind of, come to Jesus and you'll get a Calvinator. Come to Jesus and you'll get a BMW. And it's an awful, wicked, dreadful lie, and I hate it. I've got to see that the Bible, the biblical witness, rings true, and it does ring true, powerfully true, when I'm walking through the shadow of death, not just when career is going well. And as we say in the media, people whose careers are going up and up and up and up and up and up and up haven't been in the industry long. And that'll be true in most of your places. If your career's going up and up and up and up, you haven't been there long. Because if you're there for a long time, you'll have bad times. Everyone does.